place today. Some about being fed up or something.
Glad to have you here, George. Do you know about the laws of probability?
I think so. Some about a formula for something happening by chance.
Very good. What a bright lad you are.
Yeah.
For instance, if I flipped a coin 100 times, what would the laws of probability say?
50 heads and 50 tails.
Yes, wonderful.
Yeah.
It's so good to work with today's bright youngsters.
Let's
try a more interesting experiment.
Okay.
I have here 3 Las Vegas slot machines. And naturally, the odds against winning with these machines are
astronomical.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can do the improbable. Pull the first handle.
Okay.
But don't hurt your hand. Easy.
Boy, you're such a nice guy.
Oh boy, I won. Yes, you did the improbable. You beat the odds.
Yeah.
The law of probability was that you should not win.
Wow.
Try the next machine.
Okay. Jackpot. Whoa, I won again, Mr. Wizard.
What a talented youngster. Again, you've beaten the laws of probability.
Can I keep what I get?
Of course, it's coming to you.
Boy.
Try the next machine.
Wait a minute.
It's Billy.
That should be me winning. I should be beating the odds.
But Billy...
I belong in this show.
Well,
I'm going to do the last machine.
Okay, Billy. See if you can win.
Wow, really?
Imagine, folks, what could be more improbable than winning 3 machines in a row? Unless, of course, it's the improbability that the 3rd machine was rigged to explode. Well, we've got to learn to accept the twists that life throws at us.
Right.
This is Mr. Wizard.
And his good friend George.
Saying bye-bye.
And we're back in the studio here at Bells in the Bat Free. And while Mr. Wizard was playing, I opened up the envelope that said the ratings and learned the truth, which means that Aunt Harriet should be calling me right about now. Right on schedule. Hello?
Well?
Well, what, Aunt Harriet?
Your ratings.
Oh, the ratings.
Absolutely reek.
Yeah, I know that, but we're working as hard as...
No, this is completely unacceptable. Heavens to Betsy, what do I tell Percy?
I don't think Max really enters into this that much.
Percy Worthington's spine.
Yeah.
Not been Max for years. Why do you keep bringing this up?
Well, I just always knew Miss Max Swamp Bottom, but we're doing everything we can, Aunt Harriet.
I'm going to demand that you use some of my ideas.
Oh, not your ideas again.
After all, I have the money sense in the family genes that never made it to you, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, well, what are your big ideas for us this time, Aunt Harriet?
Give me a minute to think. Successful formulas for radio shows?
Oh.
Yes, I've got it. How about a political talk show?
A political talk show?
Yes, they have great ratings.
No, but politics makes me kind of itchy, Aunt Harriet. I'm not very good at that.
Trash the president.
But I like the president.
Then praise the president, then.
Well, I don't like him that much. I mean... I don't know politics, Aunt Harriet. I have to do something that I know. How about if I do, like, a cooking show? I know how to cook. What if I did that?
Okay. As long as it's conservatives versus liberals.
Cooking conservative controversy. Do you think I would do this just because you tell me to?
Yes.
Greetings to all of you connoisseurs across the fruited plain, the unfruited plain, the fruited fancy, and everybody else. This is the Hurry Flambeau Show. I'm your host and head chef of the Flambeau Institute of Conservative Recipes, with talent on loan from Julia Child. And once again, I am broadcasting with half my taste buds tied behind my tongue, just to make it fair. And now let us begin the show. I have a dilemma, my dear friends. I have here in my formerly Burger King stained fingers an invitation to prepare a meal for a bunch of liberal Democrats. So, my dear friends, this is where I need your help. I need your suggestions. So let's go to the phone. Hello, you're on the air.
That's me. Yeah, I think that you should make chicken. Yeah, chicken would be real good.
Well, that's a very good suggestion, because when conservatives make chicken, we make a delicious recipe out of the right wing. When liberals make chicken, it's just foul. Next caller.
How come you think that the Democrats can't cook poultry?
Well, the reason they can't cook poultry is, no matter what's in the oven, it always turns out that they cook their own goose.
And Monsieur Flambeau, perhaps something with the legume, eh?
Legume? No, too redundant. The Democrats are already full of beans. Next.
Yeehaw, from Texas there, Hurry. I think you ought to cook them up some steaks.
We could give them a steer to the right, if you will, instead of the usual bum steers they offer.
John!
Huh?
This isn't working.
Oh.
This cooking show is the stupidest idea you've ever had.
I've...
This is... John, you are hopeless. You are an embarrassing ambassador to the airwaves.
Well, what should I do next?
Maybe you can possibly try and do a sports show.
Sports?
Hi, everybody. The big game's coming up. That means our team's going to win the big game because there's no way our team can lose this big game because it's the big game and we're ready for this big game. Let's take our first call. Hello, you're the first caller on the big game show.
Yeah, it's going to be a big game and we're going to win that big game.
How come we're going to win that big game?
There's no way we can lose this big game. We got to win this big game because it's the big game.
It is a big game. We got to win this big game.
And we're going to win it.
And you know why we're going to win it?
Because it's the big game.
It's the big game.
Hold it.
What?
This sports thing is just not working either. You are not cut out for this. I should have guessed when you were the last one picked on the teams all the time when you were a child.
Well, what should I do?
Try public radio, yes.
Good evening. Tonight, we're going to take a 3-hour detailed look at the history of the paperclip, its invention, its development, the creative uses for paperclips through the centuries, all with it.
Could you be quiet with the piano, please?
Stop! It's not working! Try radio wrestling. Yes, go for that now.
Your best bet for financial security is a 401k!
Oh, no! Icy precious metals on which you have to go for it!
Be able to do that if anybody could.
Ooga, booga, booga, booga. Ooga, booga, booga. Oh, ooga, booga, booga, booga. Oh, booga, 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 booga.
I can't believe this. Try the All Smokers Network.
Our round table. consists of...
Okay, I got it. Try one of those supernatural shows.
So this being stepped out of the craft.
That floated over to me. It was scary.
I see, and did it communicate with you?
Yeah, he talked to me.
What did it say?
It asked me if I had any more beers in my cooler.
Forget everything. Go for a totally open line. Just throw the lines open. Let anyone call. Don't scream. Just see what you get. Good luck.
So the lines are open now for anyone to call in. Anyone? Anyone? Bueller?
Okay, stop it all. Now it's working. I have a show that everyone is going to want to listen to.
Well, things are really changing up here in the Bat Free on episode 20.
Hey, kids, this is James Messick of Almost Live Radio at almostliveradio.com. You're listening to episode 20 of Harriet's in the Bat Free. So here's the aunt who never says can't, Aunt Harriet.
Things are doing fine with Miss Porcine. It's Harriet's in the Bat Free.
Hello! This is Aunt Harriet of Ms. Porcine fame. I'm here to entertain, enlighten, give advice. I should be of great value to you, you loyal listeners. You'll soon realize wisdom only comes from someone of porcine breeding such as myself.
Thank you all for listening to Bells in the Bat Free or Harriet's in the Bat Free, episode 20, whichever it turns out to be. Written and produced by John Bell, voiced by John Bell and Becky Beach. Special material by Becky Beach. See you next week, whoever's going to be here.
Perfect teeth, her perfect little nose, but were you now Coralie? Life isn't about being head cheerleader, you know.
My friends, have we got a deal for you. In this limited time offer, you can purchase a brand new sofa recliner up to one half off. Yes, why pay up to $1,000 when you can pay down to $500 or more? These sofa recliners are more comfortable than comfortable. Plus, at this super sale, you can also pick up this bottle of new and improved sofa recliner cleaner at the amazing price of just $29.99. You heard right, $29.99. But you must call now. Operators are standing by to take your calls. And if you're one of the first 20 people to call in for the special limited time now only offer, we'll throw in a free piece of cardboard to put on under one leg of the sofa recliner to keep it from wobbling. A $60 value, absolutely free. So what are you waiting for? This is the last time you'll hear this offer until the next time you hear this offer. And as always, 90 days, same as 3 months. Call now, 800-555-BIG-DEAL. Another fantastic offer from Big Deals Incorporated, where quality is more than just a word. It's a slogan.
Hey, Brad, you think it's safe to go in yet?
I saw the ratings. We'd better wait another hour.
Ooh.
Safe sex is more than just avoiding STDs and pregnancy. No matter what you're into, be sure you and those around you feel safe, comfortable, and are having a good time.
This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
The following audio presentation is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons living or dead, events, or locations is entirely coincidental. This segment may contain mature language, situations, and violence. Listener discretion is advised.
Listening to Hodes Grimm, the audiobook drama.
Epigraph. From beyond the door came the chatter of bones, the remains of those coaxed to black ends in that beastly hollow, that place of darkness and teeth. Oh, how they hunger in that terrible grim. The Gib Goblins by Ed Hoad.
Say, kids, what time is it?
He's just walking out on the stage, and here he goes with Heartbreak Motel.
Well, we'll start at the end of
Lone
Street.
Duty boys and
girl, howdy. I guess
her. She's gone for good. Prologue. Sutton Valley, New York. The cycles ended forever in November of 1956. A gallon of gas cost 23 cents. Minimum wage paid 3/4. The Soviets just ended the uprising in Hungary. Eisenhower was re-elected. Elvis Presley was huge. And Ed Philip Hoad was routinely stewed to the hat on whiskey, the only remaining fuel for his faulty inner engines. He knew he had a drinking problem, just as he knew that he had voices that demanded to be heard through his work. They were parts of the same animal that, when left to hunger, lashed out in red bursts that frightened his wife, frightened even him. They extorted him for years, condemning him to refuel the engines and conduct their business. A bitter and lonely business in a dim office with closed doors. They ate at whatever they could. The love in his marriage, his time with his son Gary, who deserved the attentive father that Ed never had. Ed had grown tired of being governed by the things in his inner places and seeing the outer world through a haze. They always coaxed him back to their will, scared him, tricked him, rewired his mind and memory. They wouldn't be denied. He had to feed them. He didn't know how not to. Until 2 months ago, when the writing stopped. Whether it was due to his marital turmoil, the failure of his second book, or because he had become conscious of the cycles that plagued his life, Ed didn't know. Words could not find their way out of the noise in his mind. He stared at nothing while time passed, and a page in the typewriter remained blank. His debt was growing. He had lost his job at the Sutton Valley Gazette, was in danger of losing his house on the hill at 34 Saybrook Road, and was trying to swallow the terrible pill that Barbara might have left him for good. 2 weeks with no sign of her. He dealt with it the only way he knew how. If there's stress, relieve it by any means. If there's pain, take medicine. If it gets worse, up the dosage. Common sense. He was heavily oiled. The morning he glanced out the window and saw an unfamiliar car on the shady cul-de-sac. The black Ford sat in front of his house, its round headlights staring over the chrome grimace of the grill. The seats empty. The leaf-covered pavement continued on past the home of the Morgans. Pretty Betty and her brawny trash mouth of a husband, Roy, who was washing his 48 Oldsmobile. Ed shambled to the window. He heard Pat Boone singing on the radio about how he almost lost his mind, and heard the TV that he had just seen his son playing near, setting up a camp of army men on the carpet.
What'd I tell you about having both those things on? Pick one or the other, son, unless you want to pay for the electricity.
Radio's not on, Pa.
My ears don't lie to me, so shut it off already.
He braced a hand on the window frame, leaned, and peered toward the Cape House next door. A modest home for the family of a money man like Henry Boggs. Beside the jutting back fenders of a new caddy, Henry held a rake and talked to a man in a long coat and hat who jotted notes on a pad. When the man glanced through his thick-framed glasses, Ed recognized him as John Broward, the detective, who had stopped by many times since Ed reported Barbara missing. Only this time, Broward had come to see his neighbors. Ed didn't like that any more than their faces, which showed nothing favorable as they kept glancing toward his house. Ed swiveled his head toward Gary, who was belly down on the floor in his pajamas, dark bangs hanging down to his brows.
Need to go talk to a man outside. Be a good boy and stay put. Play with your soldiers till I get back.
My soldiers.
You hear me?
Yes, Pa.
His voice was distant, dreamy, and he didn't look at Ed, which might have made Ed sore if he wasn't so taken by the sight of his child playing, imagining, dreaming, as creative children dream. A smile crept up, but didn't spread to his eyes. They were too haunted by the sight of this ghost.
My soldiers.
Your soldiers. Yes, they are. You still own the dreams, my boy. God, don't you ever become like your old man. Don't grow up to let them own you. Own you. Own you. Own you. Own you. Own you.
Barefoot. Clad in a shirt and trousers he had slept in twice, Ed walked outside onto the porch where the light met him harshly. His hair was unkempt, grown out from his usual flat top, tufts of it hooked down against his forehead and commas. Henry freed a hand from his cardigan sweater, straightened his cap, and made a motion that prompted Broward to turn.
Speak of the devil, and the devil appears.
Broward grinned and waved. Ed did neither. He waited. When Broward approached, Ed leaned against a column. Brown hat, charcoal coat, Broward peered up through his glasses.
Mr. Hode, I was about to give a rap on your door.
Have you found her?
I'm afraid not.
He said, the sympathy in his voice too great to believe.
Frankly, everyone's concerned.
No more than I.
Of course.
Broward gave a wistful smile, and Ed didn't believe in that either.
It saddens me when I think of your son. Child needs a mother. This must be very hard on him.
His dog ran away, and then his mother, too. If I didn't care for her, I might say they're from the same stock. Yeah, the boy's holding up better than I am. I don't have his strength.
If you don't mind me saying so,
Ed waved a permitting hand.
I can tell you that you smell like a saloon, and I'm not even downwind.
Broward fiddled with his hat when Ed said nothing.
We all deal,
Pausing, he looked pensive, and Ed knew why. Men who stopped to choose words had different dialogue in mind.
We all deal, with things in our own way. Things we could have done, things we did.
There it was.
Your son will need you now more than ever. Perhaps you shouldn't go on the bottle so much.
It calms the devils.
Devils, Mr. Hode?
Ed supposed that stopping to choose words was an example he should follow.
Every man's got 'em.
Broward nodded slowly.
And some men have dark sides, too.
Some men hide them. Man is evil, inherently. If you think William Golding was whistling Dixie, you don't watch the news.
William who?
Doesn't matter. Because we're not really talking about philosophy or literature anyway, are we?
Mr. Hode.
Don't Mr. Hode me. I know what you're driving this conversation to, and I resent it.
Ed met his eyes, those dark, studious spotters beneath his hat brim.
You're talking to my neighbors and shaking my tree to see if rotten apples fall. I know how the world works. I know you're doing your job. Because I respect that, I saw to it that we wouldn't be on bad terms. As I could not forgive being insulted in my own house.
You never invited me in.
And I just told you why.
Broward opened his mouth as if to retort and snapped it shut.
That's fair.
He cleaned his glasses with a handkerchief he plucked from his coat.
You must admit that these are suspicious circumstances. I find very curious that she took nothing when she left. Not even her clothes, her gloves, or coat.
He blinked and slipped his glasses back on.
Her purse?
It's odd, yes.
Broward flipped through his notes.
When she disappeared, Gary was at school and you were napping.
Ed nodded and didn't clarify that he hadn't napped exactly, but drank himself into the black.
Between, 10 and noon.
12:30, yeah.
Betty Morgan.
Broward gestured down the cul-de-sac.
Was outside gardening and should have witnessed Barbara leaving. Surely your Barbara wouldn't have gone through the woods.
Betty must have missed her, because somebody got the mail.
The mail?
Ed flagged out an arm.
Mailboxes are out on the street. Barbara always got the mail. The box was empty when I checked.
You checked the mailbox?
Broward looked enlightened.
Were you expecting anything? Payment for your work, perhaps?
No.
I presume you must be paid fairly well in order to...
Writers don't get rich. They get burned. They burn up or burn out.
Ed wanted another drink now.
Perhaps there was no mail. It happens.
Broward crossed his arms, tapping his notepad against his shoulder.
Now, if a car, say a salesman, had come, wouldn't you say that Betty would have noticed? That, Martha Boggs next door would have heard it?
Ed pegged them as trick questions and shrugged.
The Boggs have heard arguments between you and your wife.
No marriage is perfect. Everything she wanted from me that she didn't think she was getting. So maybe she went to get them someplace else.
Yes, the wayward theory.
Call it what you want.
Sifts insists that Barbara would have not dropped contact with them. Have you talked at all with...
No. You already knew that. They think I'm no good for her. We don't talk.
They have this very crazy idea that you might have done something to her.
The words entered his mind and looped there as some things did, like plot ideas or radio jingles or that damn Mr. Sandman song from the Cordettes.
You might have done something to her.
I'd never.
Are you sure you were napping?
Yes.
It is crazy, isn't it?
If your eyes could see in my heart, you'd know it is.
Broward tilted his head back, pausing, and brought it back down, completing a nod.
Well spoken.
His eyes lowered and rose.
But as you said, men have dark sides. Some hide it, but not always. You choose your moments.
You presuppose that I have a choice.
You certainly don't hide it in your work.
Ed had a feeling it might come to that.
Am I supposed to feel embarrassed now for writing rubbish?
Your words, not mine.
I know what some people say.
I had a look at one of your books.
Now should I be impressed that you read my rubbish?
I had to ask myself a very relevant question.
Very is your favorite qualifier.
What can be said of a person who writes such stories?
Anything at all.
Very sorry if I've offended you in any way. I just find it fascinating, actually, why someone would elect to write stories about...
I didn't elect them. They elected me.
Broward looked puzzled.
The book was called...
He consulted his notes.
The Jazz Manglers?
Jazzamanglers.
What's a Jazzamangler exactly?
I thought you read it.
He sounded shocked by the implication, as if he had been asked if he ever put on a tutu and licked a monkey's ass.
No, I prefer lighter reading. Yours was dark. I found it disturbing. Had to put it down. Can't say that I liked it.
Yeah, the critics didn't like it either.
Ed rolled his eyes.
New York Times said it was murdered by metaphors.
You should also know that I find the dark overtones of this conversation disturbing, too.
You started it. Now I'm gonna finish it.
Ed headed for the door.
Have yourself a very good day.
He heard Broward say,
"We'll talk again."
And had no doubt. Ed returned to the living room, where army men prepared for battle, and Gary was nowhere in sight, probably upstairs in his room, to get reinforcements. Buffalo Bob said on the TV,
"Fakeheads, what time is it?"
It was howdy doody time, of course, and that freckly-faced marionette gave Ed the creeps, maybe because he identified with him too well. Booze was Ed's Buffalo Bob, the strings, his cycles and muses, the puppeteers, the things inside that moved him. Without Buffalo Bob, howdy doody had no voice. Without the puppet strings, no motion. Take away that and Ed supposed the peanut gallery would still cheer and giggle their heads off, but there would be nothing happy about those sounds. They would be mad. Hungry. If Howdy Doody and his cousin Heidi and Mr. Bluster just lay around, drained of magic, Ed imagined the little devils would rush off the bleachers and rip up the citizens of Doodyville for the entertainment they weren't getting.
Nobody is going to make me leave Doodyville and my pal Howdy Doody.
You think you're special now.
He spoke to the TV, which for Ed Hoad was not unusual.
Poor little guy. Howdy duty time won't last forever. I'll find some other puppet.
He shut it off. He shuffled into the kitchen, where he stopped at the sight of his upright freezer that he had come to think of as a symbol of everything wrong in his life. After Henry Boggs bought a freezer and Martha gabbed to Barbara about it, Barbara wanted one too. Ed scoffed at the idea whenever she brought it up, at the same time saving up the money. The freezer looked new, which helped keep his secret that he had bought it used. Months later, he didn't feel as clever. It was a power hog. Glitchy and no bargain. He wished he had listened to Barbara when she argued it should go in the garage. It made the kitchen feel cluttered. It stood out there, didn't belong there, but he had his say, and there it went, where visitors could see it. Stubborn pride on display.
What's the point of having a luxury that nobody knows you have?
Was his argument, but Ed had had plans for it. He didn't want it far from his office. He preferred his liquor.
culled. If it came down to survival, he would take his hooch warm and poured from a used ashtray as readily as he would eat bread off a dirty floor. But he loved it culled, from the bottleneck, not with rocks that would melt and water it down, not in a glass he would have to refill. His ability to concentrate had become precarious, frayed by such little things as his liquor going lukewarm or refilling a glass. He used to keep two bottles in the freezer at a time, sandwiched between the TV dinners and Wonder Cake or ice cream, and swap them now and then as he answered the calls of his bladder, a distraction for which there was no remedy but relief. He had connected his work, cold booze, and that freezer, threaded them together and tied himself into a knot. As he stared at it now, he thought of the whiskey that lay beside the Thanksgiving turkey that wouldn't be cooked this year. If he saw the bottle, the feel-good memory of cold liquor down his gullet would spark a demand. Then he would end up behind the typewriter with a cramping brain that produced no words, and angry muses who would start eating him up again. He didn't want that. He didn't want a drink either, as he was already tanked. He didn't want to open the freezer. That's where his demons were. He felt them pulling. Resisting the movers when they yanked his strings, sometimes felt as if he was yanking back and drawing them closer. The fear that brought him, however irrational, usually made him cave. When his resolve held, they conspired to make him forget it and spoke in one united voice through a door in his imagination.
You don't really believe you can change? To what end? So you can be a better man for Barbara? You jest. But there's no point in trying now. She's gone. Your work is all that's left. Get to it. Open the door.
Ed did not trust that voice. However persuasive, it was deceptive. It was the addict voice of the watchers and movers in his inner darkness, the masters of his illusions, parts of himself that had gone cannibal. The Gibgoblins, in his personal grim. Like those creatures from his first book, they could not reach him, much less gnaw, if he stayed clear of their door. Drawing that parallel might not have come natural to a man who didn't think in metaphors, or who wasn't a writer. A superstitious animal that made baseball players with rituals seem mild by comparison, but Ed was both.
Never again.
He felt betrayed by the lack of conviction in his voice. Doubts descended, black clouds behind his bloodshot eyes, and he thought,
who am I kidding?
The thought of the liquor inside that had to be cold, so wonderfully cold, intoxicated him, and he advanced. His eyes filled with desire, the first steps across the checkered floor, urgent, closer. Pain jabbed his foot. Cursing, he squinted down at what he had stepped on. He crouched and saw it was an army man, kneeling with a bazooka.
Damn that boy. How many times?
Ed stopped and considered how many times he had stepped out of his cycles, battled them hard only to throw it away at a weak moment and find himself back at square one. He had come just as close other times in the past 2 weeks.
It's become a cycle of its own.
He laughed at the absurdity. He had laughed the other times too, but they were sad laughs. Because the only thing worse than living life like a skipping record was being fully aware of it. He told himself that if the soldier hadn't jolted him out of the trance, the fear would have. Ever since the last hallucination that had seemed frighteningly real, he had feared that it would happen again. Days before Barbara disappeared, he had opened the freezer while his eyes yawned drunkenly elsewhere. A mindless ritual, he would reach in and grab for the bottle. That time, he had groped at nothing but cold air. His eyes had widened when they looked into the freezer. An impossible window into a black abyss where frost clouds drifted and formless things swam and struggled to take shape. The origin of the low, snarling voice which said,
"You left us hungry and we'll have to find something else to eat. We'll have to eat you up instead. Eat you from the inside out, and you'll be inside us instead. We'll be you and you'll be us, because what we eat is what we are."
Ed had slammed the door with a cry that summoned Barbara. He had never told her and hadn't opened the freezer since. That had been the first time he consciously thought of the Gibgoblins in context with the freezer and his writing, which was solidified by the nightmare he had the same night. He had dreamt that he had gone into his office and the air was hazed with smoke, smelling sweet and spicy. It came from the warped pipe of the leprechaun, who sat in his chair in its traditional green garb, booted feet up on the desk.
"Find the magic in your snout. Keep your skin, you're inside out,"
the leprechaun had said between puffs. "Keep drinking and writing" had been Ed's interpretation, and there was no doubting the meaning of inside out. His insides were full of monsters. No matter how well caged, sooner or later, they broke out. Words on a page, explosions of temper, hallucinations. Whatever the means, whatever the shape, the monsters found their way out. Ed walked into his office. The door opened in beside his bar and a painting of his father. Bookshelves flanked the room, and his desk faced away from windows that looked into the forest. He settled into his chair and grabbed his whiskey bottle off the desk, where he had left it beside his Underwood typewriter. He brought the bottle to his lips, tipped it, and stopped.
"Enough."
He dropped the bottle in the wastebasket. He looked out the window for a long while, staring through the trees. He thought of how Gary liked to play with his army men in the dirt of the side yard, and he thought of the house. His eyes widened a notch, and he stared at the trees. Wood. He doubted anyone stopped to consider that they made their homes inside the mutilated remains of another life form. The corpses of trees, as if living in houses of bones. He had read stories about haunted bones, often the bones of bad people, evil bones. Now, he contemplated wood from evil trees. What made them evil? Surely the same thing that made people evil. The environment in which they grew. The dirt from which they derived nourishment. From tainted grounds, desecrated grounds, it didn't matter. He had enough to start with. His world changed in seconds, filled with confidence and hope where there had been none. He knew that he could draft a great book from that premise, one that would surpass the success of the Gibgoblins and lessen his debt. Ed had the world in his hands again. Lines of text forming in his head, Ed produced a stack of pages from a desk drawer and fed one into the typewriter. He lit a cigar, a task of many steps yet mindless. Once his hands were free, he pounded out the opening lines. The machine gun clack of the typewriter and ching of the carriage return were good sounds, good magic. He scanned the text. Behind his eyes, the next line formed, and he held it there in the mental womb as he reached for nothing. The magic stopped. Record skipped again, and he stared at the corner of his desk where he had reached for.
"I don't need it. There's no magic in the stout. No magic. It's already here. It's inside."
His eyes yawed to the side, looked inside for that next sentence, which was now gone, and fixed on the page. He told himself he would remember if he reread what he had written, but that was not there either. Instead,
"Cold whiskey. I forgot my cold whiskey. I cannot work without a cold drink. I am a bad puppet for even trying to. A bad puppet for not getting my cold whiskey out of the freezer. I cannot write without it. I cannot write without it."
Ed revolted from it, stumbled back into the wall between the windows. The magic was gone, the excitement of his new inspiration dim, the enthusiasm a ghost. The typewriter no longer his friend, and he wanted it all back. He wanted it now. The flames of that desire consumed him, and he stormed into the kitchen. He wrenched open the freezer door. He snatched out the bottle that was frosty and welcome in his warm hands. The whiskey was sure to be slushy and robbed of flavor, but it was cold, and it had his medicine. With a manic grin, he returned to his desk, where his cigar burned mellowly. He wrestled with the bottle cap and looked at the page he had started, seeing... The Indians told Robert Maurer that the land westward of Saffron Creek was bad, the soil tainted, but the land was no longer theirs, and the land was cheap. It now belonged to Robert, who owned the Maurer Lumber Company.
Yeah.
When he raised the bottle, the next line of text returned from the darkness in perfect condition. He brought the bottle to his lips and stopped.
The ancient trees there would soon come down.
He said the line, which was simple, logical, unremarkable. His voice of reason came.
Do you mean to tell me that you have to drink in order to type the ancient trees there would soon come fucking down? Do you know how absurd that is? Oh, and by the way, the words came back and you haven't had a swig yet.
He picked up his cigar, puffed thoughtfully, eyes moving between the typewriter and the bottle. His face writhed into a grimace. He shoved the cigar through the bottleneck into his cold well of spirits, and it joined the whiskey with a sizzle. One eye twitching, he shook the bottle crazily and lobbed it. It hurtled toward a portrait of his father, a stage actor who had committed suicide, and crashed in a flurry of shards and dirty liquor.
Don't need you.
He meant it.
How many times have we dumped out a bottle or smashed it? How many times have we thought we meant it? How many? How many?
He looked at the typewriter, and what he saw on the page once again knocked every door inside him off their hinges. It sent him into a screaming rampage. He picked up the typewriter and hurled it into the shelves. It crashed to the floor, books spilled down, and he seized it again. It smashed into the bar next. Bottles jangled, distracting him, and he smashed them all on the counter, against the wall, flung them like bombs, laughing madly. All the while, his hand wrenched the page from the typewriter, stuffed it in his mouth, and he chewed while he punished the typewriter. Finally, he carried the maimed thing toward a window. He stopped. A better idea popped out from the fires behind his eyes, and he stormed into the kitchen with it.
You can have it!
He flung open the freezer door and drove the typewriter in, the slice of his mind still functioning, expecting to have to jam it between shelves. But the freezer led to the black place again. The typewriter sailed into the darkness, and Ed almost went with it. He caught himself, gazing into the grim, while hot piss flowed down his legs, unaware that he was still laughing, and that he was a bloody mess from cutting himself on bottle shards.
Come on in. Water's fine.
Things stirred and giggled behind the frosty door, and he knew what he would find at the bottom of their darkness, and that would be just fine. If he was wrong and his eyes lied, he had a gun that would do the job splendidly.
I end it now.
If he didn't, he might not ever. He might calm down, feel better for a while, but then it would be more of the same. He never believed in spirits that carried on or in heaven, but he did believe in hell. He had been living there for years uncounted. The flames may have been metaphorical, the pain and suffering inside instead of out, but those things weren't what made hell what it was, as much as endless repetition. The last remnant of the man inside the monster conjured the image of Gary. He locked up, trembling violently in indecision.
Gary's gone,
said his voice from across the kitchen, and he looked bloody crazed, wide eyes set in dark circles. He saw himself.
He's dead, and you know it. What? No, he's upstairs. Gary's upstairs.
All that noise would have brought him down. We both know what happened. We took care of him.
Yes, we did.
No.
I'm afraid so.
Another voice made Ed snap his head toward the office doorway. Detective Broward stood there in his charcoal coat and hat.
Some have dark sides, Mr. Hoad.
We took care of Barbara, too.
His dark side said...
Napping, that's good. Let's drink some more alibis. They're all free in your house of bones, brother. Let's drink it all.
Ed jerked his head up toward the ceiling, wailing.
Gary!
He stormed through the house, thundered up the stairs, tripped on a top step, tumbled into the hall, and scrambled into Gary's room.
Gary!
His feet crashed through a festival of matchbox cars, Lincoln logs, and little people. Between containers of Play-Doh and Pez dispensers, a platoon of army men lined the dresser. He swooped down for a look under the bed, jumped up and yanked open the closet. Stuffed animals and game boxes avalanched.
Gary, where are you?
We took care of him.
Ed tore back through the house and outside, where Henry Boggs stiffened on the walkway.
Oh, Lord. What happened?
When Ed ran around the house, Henry followed.
Ed!
Gary's bicycle lay in the yard, removing the chance that he had ridden off scared, as he often did when Ed lost his head.
Gary!
Pale. Henry moved his mouth with no words that Ed could hear. What he heard was Broward, who stood a little behind Henry.
I think you murdered your son just as you murdered your wife.
I didn't. I didn't kill my son. I didn't kill my family.
Henry backed away with his hands raised. You did. His wide eyes said,
Oh my God, you really did.
I didn't kill my son! I didn't kill my family! I didn't!
Dishes clanked, drawing Ed's gaze to the window over the sink. Barbara gazed back, curls snaking down over her face. Henry ran for his house, one arm up and hand on his hat. When Ed bolted into his, he found Barbara in the kitchen. Her hair disheveled, green dress tattered, skin... pale.
How could you?
He took hold of her, and a chill ran up his arms.
Are you all right? Where have you been? Where'd you go?
Would you like to see?
Her lips parted over jagged teeth. He revolted from her.
You're not Barbara!
A glow rose in her eyes, irises green and rippling, like holes in reality, to a place where green flames burned. He motioned for the living room. Buffalo Bob and his cowboy garb blocked his way, pointing.
There's no place for you in Dutyville now, mister.
The kitchen filled with people.
You didn't pay attention, and they ate me up. You let them eat me up.
Gary said. Broward nodded behind him.
Yes, I think we have enough evidence for a conviction.
Ed cupped his hands over his ears.
None of you are real.
Oh, don't you worry now, Edward.
His mother said. In a frilly apron and gaudy dress too small for her large frame, she cooked on the stove.
If I cooked them up just the way you like it, you wouldn't eat it anywho.
Plastic army men sizzled and melted on a frying pan.
This is how you always take them.
You are hereby convicted of eating your family, said Judge Freewin, who Ed once stood before after a barroom brawl in 1949. Have you anything to say before we commence the sentencing?
Ed's fingers curled, tightened around his hair, yanked.
Not true. None of this is true.
Oh, how they hunger in that terrible grim.
Oh, how they hunger.
Barbara stepped to the side. From behind her came Ed's father, a gaunt man with a deep-lined face and a bullet hole in his head, while the others snarled and hissed, and Howdy Doody giggled in the window over the sink. His father cleared his throat and recited the text off a crumpled page as he might a Shakespearean passage.
The Indians told Robert Mauer that the land westward of Saffron Creek was bad, the soil tainted, but the land was no longer theirs.
Ed's dark twin snatched away the page and ate it. Ed backed as the crowd closed in, grinning with cannibal teeth, eyes filled with hunger.
Guess what time it is?
Howdy doody time.
Buffalo Bob shook his head slowly. Barbara cackled, a sound not sane or human. Ed felt frigid air, saw frost wafting out around his head, and whirled toward a black opening in the world. Arms rushed out, clawed hands gripped and pulled him through the door that slammed shut behind him. Demons take demon shapes. Inside Out. Ed Hode went into the grim. Now theirs. There, he suffered the fate of the Jazzamanglers. Murdered by metaphors.
This has been an audio presentation of Hode's Grim, the audiobook drama. Visit us on the web at www.jack-kincaid.com/enter-the-grim. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Eddie Winters, and you're listening to Mutiny Radio, the same great station with a great new name.
Wow, cool.
What's cool?
The new name? What? I thought the radio's talking to me. That's weird.
What was weird?
This. I'm talking to a podcast. That's impossible.
Not really. This is Mutiny Radio. If you're listening, we're listening to...
Cool.
Mutiny Radio, the evolution... has begun.
The following audio presentation is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons living or dead, events, or locations is entirely coincidental. This segment may contain mature language, situations, and violence. Listener discretion is advised.
You are listening to Hode's Grim, the audiobook drama.
Chapter 1. The Hammer Man. 19 years ago, shortly after he graduated from Barksdale High in the summer of 1988, Chad Hyman killed two people. With a pair of imaginary scissors he made with his hand. The enormity of it hadn't truly hit him until months later, when he was a struggling college student stuck with an art class that he was sure to flunk. Chad didn't know how to recognize or appreciate art, but was taken by a painting of the Fates, the weavers of destiny from Greek mythology, or so he was told, the lives of people, the normal, mortal people, where flimsy threads spun and snipped at the whim of the sisters. He never forgot that painting or the name of the one who did the cutting. Whenever he had stared at the scissors in the hands of Atropos, it brought him back to the night he had cut the threads of Roger Began and Stacy Kern from Sumner Bay, a small lakefront city 15 miles northeast of the Barksdale-Sutton Valley area. One could argue that what Chad did was an act of self-defense. It was either Roger and Stacy, or Chad and his best friend, Ben Norwood. Death already had 4 kids in its wagon and wanted 2 more. No one knew it at the time. No one ever knows when death is in attendance to make a claim, or which of life's little crossroads up ahead it might be waiting at. Around 3 in the morning, they stood on the driveway of a frat house in Sumner Bay, where a party was winding down. Their friend Alan had driven them there and left them stranded. Not that this was out of his character. The last group with a car had just come out. 4 kids from Sutton Valley. As unpleasant as the driver, Chris Purvis, seemed, he offered rides. Chad and Ben didn't know him, and neither did Roger Began and his girlfriend Stacy, who wanted a ride to the Sumner Bay outskirts. Between them, Purvis had no favorites. 2 people already in the back seat, his freckle-faced girlfriend in the passenger seat. He would take 2 more. Only 2. Chad and Roger wrangled over it. Both tall and strong, they stood on even ground, if words became more. Purvis had revved the engine.
"Bus is leaving, assholes,"
he had said, his face half hidden behind long hair, cigarette burning.
"You've got 30 seconds to sort it out, or all 4 of you can kiss my ass. Flip a coin or something."
Ben offered.
"Rock, paper, scissors?"
"Fine. You game?"
"Let's go." Chad didn't know any more than Roger that their hands had just become lethal weapons. Roger's girlfriend Stacy stood to the side, hugging herself in Roger's varsity football jacket. While Ben counted, Chad suspected that Roger would go with Rock. It was the macho thing to do, so Chad would do paper. One decision, however small and inconsequential it may seem at the time, could change a person's life. It could end it, too. But Chad changed his mind at the last moment. He came out with scissors. Roger Began chose Rock.
"The lovebirds ride,"
Purvis said, legitimizing it. Not long after, everyone in that car was dead, most on impact. Stacy was the last to go as the EMTs tried to extract her from the mangle of metal the car had become after being struck by a train. Only those who died knew for sure what happened, but the tires had left no marks to suggest that Purvis braked. Chad hadn't really known the 6 who died. He never felt guilty either, even if he felt bad. He never asked himself why he and Ben had lived instead of Roger Began and Stacy Kern. He never stopped to consider that he lived because fate had other things in mind, or God had plans for him, or any such hooey. Because that would have meant that some people were disposable, serving no purpose except to die or suffer to show the lucky people that they were on Earth for a reason. It would have meant that there was some intelligent but brutal design behind things, instead of a random mess of flimsy threads. People's adult lives start at different times. Chad Hyman's had started that night when he was 18, when all that stood between life and death was a drunken game of rock, paper, scissors. If he had stuck with paper, he wouldn't have gone to college or flunked out of it. He never would have met Patricia Guerin, much less married her with Ben as his best man. Trish wouldn't have given birth to their daughter Caroline or their son Buck. They wouldn't own a sedan, a jeep, and the modest house at 819 Hulls Hill Road in Sutton Valley, near the Barksdale town line. There would be no they at all. Through the years, whenever Chad stopped to take stock of his life, his mind drove him back to those crossroads in time, and the humbling thought came.
I am here because I chose scissors.
Crazy, but true. It flashed in his head, the January morning.